and thanks for joining us once again on Core Ideas, the podcast where we delve into all things related to lake sediments. As always, my name is Adam Jeziorski, joined by my good friend Josh Steenpont.
Hey, how's it going, everyone?
And today, we are continuing our current arc, looking at current topics in the world of paleolimnology. And we're going to discuss algal blooms. And we have an extra special guest here, as we've brought in an expert on cyanobacterial blooms, Dr. Liz Favot, who we both know quite well. She is an ex-perlite and a former colleague, but she recently graduated just late last year, finished her PhD, and now works for the Federation of Ontario Cottagers Associations, or FOCA, as the Assistant Lake Stewardship Coordinator. So thanks for joining us, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
I thought you were wrong when you said late last year, and then I realized, oh, right, we're into 2021 already.
Well, technically, I did defend at the end of January.
Oh, okay. Even more recent than that. Wow. Newly minted. That's fine. Newly minted Doctor of Lakes. Very good. Well, yeah, thanks for coming on. Because this is a topic that we've kind of talked a little bit about algal blooms and eutrophication and the linkage or lack of linkage between those things a couple times. We talked a little bit about the methods, but we've never really had a full dive into the topic. And it really is a topical one, and that's probably because Adam and I don't know that much about it. So it's good to have someone else on.
Absolutely. Yeah, because Liz's graduate work was entirely focused on blooms. Is that correct? There was no other kind of digressions. It was all blooms all the time.
No, yeah, pretty much just focusing on the long-term drivers of recent blooms.
Fantastic. Okay.
Long-term drivers of recent blooms. That's an interesting one to put together. The benefits and the useful things that paleolimnology is for. So that's good to get into that.
All right. So I guess before we get started, we'll just point out that, you know, we are focused on lakes, and so we're going to really focus on the limnological aspect of cyanobacterial blooms, but this is, in terms of sheer scale, very much a marine issue, in terms of, I guess, the volume and size of blooms that occur on the planet. But here we're talking about impacts on freshwaters, maybe kind of throw it to you, Liz, to get us started. Like, what are cyanobacteria?
Yeah, so cyanobacteria are the world's oldest photosynthetic bacteria, and also like the world's oldest photosynthesizers. So they're a lot different from the other algae that we look at because they're prokaryotic compared to like the other algae groups, like the diatoms and the green algae that are eukaryotic. So they're just a really ancient form of life that's ubiquitous in our environment. It lives everywhere that has some light. It lives on glaciers. It lives in Antarctic lakes that are permanently ice covered, in all the oceans and all the lakes. So yeah, the cyanobacteria are everywhere and they're really old organisms.
And these would historically, I'm not sure when the distinction appeared, but if you hit a textbook old enough, they have been called the blue-green algae.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, and that's where like a lot of the misconception comes from, like that people call them algae, but they're not, they're actually a lot different from all of the other algae groups.
And at one point they were called cyanophyta is another group name that people refer to them as, a whole phylum of life. So there's a lot of confusing names around such tiny little things that have been around for such a long time period.
Yeah. That one I only found out recently too. Like, I think I called them cyanophytes in my thesis and John Small was like, no, like that's outdated. You can't call them that anymore. Cyanobacteria only.
Do you have a sense of when blue-green algae got phased out? Because I don't know if I'm crazy or if I would have remembered that from like high school textbooks. Or am I like...
I don't know.
Misremembering. Doesn't matter.
I don't know when it got phased out. Yeah.
Well, it's still by far the most common thing you hear them referred to as.
Yeah, still blue-green algae. Like,
Is that a problem? Like, yeah.
I think it's kind of a problem. Yeah. Yeah, I do. Because like, well, I don't know. And then people start getting mixed up and call them like green blue algae or green algae. And they don't really know actually what they're talking about. And like I said, like cyanobacteria are so much different from the other algae groups. So I really think we should just call them cyanobacteria. It's not that hard a word.
I think that's important because if it's just a nerdy taxonomy thing among scientists, so that, who cares? But no, I agree. I think there is a difference. And all algae get painted with a bad brush because of a lot of times things that people are associating with cyanobacteria. Not to say other algae aren't gross in some ways, but in some types, depending on what's going on. But no, I agree. And one of the main issues about algae that gets people unhappy in general is when there are blooms of them, whether they're green algae, whether they're maybe not diatom blooms, don't necessarily annoy people too much, but certainly cyano blooms. So one thing I guess we could start at, is there a true definition of what a bloom is? And also, how would we distinguish the difference between sort of air quotes, normal bloom that would occur and one that maybe people actually should start to worry about?
So I think that's like another big issue is that there isn't a specific definition of a bloom. Like it's generally considered when there's a visible accumulation of algae, but you can measure that in different ways. Like you can measure it through cell counts or concentrations of a certain photosynthetic pigment, or percentage of the algal community that's made up of by one certain species or a certain group of species. So no, there's no scientific definition of a bloom, and there's different ways to measure it. And at the same time, like telling a blue-green algal bloom apart from other types of algal blooms or even just other phenomena in the water can be really difficult just to do by eye. When you look at under a microscope, it's pretty easy. But for example, like there's lots of calls that come into the government about even just like pollen on the water being confused for blue-green algae. And I think because they're not always like the same, they can be red colored blooms that are cyanobacteria. So they don't always look the same. So it's hard to tell just by eye.
Yeah, that turquoise paint is not always going to be what you see.
Often, yeah, but not always.
It makes it a big problem, yeah. Mm-hmm. But they can be harmful. And that is a concern. So there are reasons to be concerned if you have large accumulations of cyanobacteria in your cottage lake or your lake that you live on. And some taxa tend to form those kind of issues and others just don't, or are a little bit less problematic. So there's some that we should be more concerned about. Is that where should we start with those guys, I guess?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, well, there's like 2,700 about named species of cyanobacteria. And there's probably only like a couple dozen that form blooms in fresh waters. And there's like some really common groups that form blooms that can be harmful. So like I can think of some of the pelagic bloom formers off the top of my head. It's like Microcystis groups, Anabaena, which is now called Dolichospermum, Gliotrichia or Phanizomenon. And then there's also some benthic bloom formers. But yeah, out of like the thousands of species of cyanobacteria that there are, there's lots of picocyanobacteria or really small cyanobacteria that live unicellularly just by themselves and don't form blooms. So there's really, it's more like the colonial and filamentous forms that form these blooms that can be harmful for many different reasons. They can be harmful.
So going back to the bloom kind of definition, or as much of the one there is, how much of it is a visual? Can you have a problematic bloom that isn't basically invisible or small enough that people can't actually notice it? Or if you don't, is it one of those things that, because the definite, you know, when you see pictures in newspapers and on the internet and stuff when they're talking about blooms, they're talking about like pea soup. Like there's no way you won't go, you know what, I'm gonna go get a nice glass of that water and throw it back. Everyone be like, oh, that's disgusting, keep it away from me. But when we're talking about the harmful ones in terms of toxins and whatnot, can they go unnoticed, I guess is what I'm kind of trying to get at on a visual level.
Yeah, I definitely think they can. Because like when you see those big, sometimes like you can get scums rather than a bloom, which is more rare, and it's like specific weather conditions that will cause a bloom to turn into a scum. And usually it has to do with the cells losing their buoyancy control. But yeah, you can have, because the toxins are, some cyanobacteria produce toxins and they can be released from the cells and live in the water or persist in the water, not living, they're just chemicals, persist in the water for several weeks after the bloom is gone, and they're not visible. So, or yeah, the bloom can be dispersed throughout the water column and might not be obvious to the naked eye. So they can be harmful, and you can have a bloom even when it's not super obvious, like some of those classic photos that they always post when they say there's a bloom.
Yeah, that's like the main thing that, because I don't know a lot about this topic, but when we get asked by the local group around town that is on centered on this lake that we live on, Lake Scugog, because there are recent issues with blooms, is that just because you see a bloom doesn't mean that it's producing toxins. And mm-hmm. just because the bloom is now gone, it doesn't mean the toxins are gone either, if they were ever there to begin with. And trying to get that disconnect into people's minds is that once it's gone, it's not flushed away necessarily. There could easily be still harmful potential effects is, I think, the hardest challenge, at least in our local community.
Definitely. Yeah. I don't think we have the technology yet or like the manpower to be able to test enough. So like say there is a bloom and it is producing toxins, then we just kind of like our governments here kind of just like leave the lake as like potentially dangerous until the end of the season, and we don't really have the testing to be able to like give the all clear, which really sucks for people living on the lake.
Yeah, I could walk down and I'd have to wipe the snow off of the sign that says blue green algae, stay out of the water in Lake Scugog, but it's still there. It's been driven into the ground. That sign is living on this lake forever. That's just don't go in the water in the downtown area. That's now the standard.
It's that. When do you have any sense of when that sign went in?
Yeah, I could tell you the day. If I searched in my emails, it was a very busy day. It was a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, probably something like that, in the summer. And it was, you know, it's not particularly surprising. Like if people had been working on this lake for a while, you go out to the lake, you'll find Microcystis out in the lake. You'll find Anabina, what I forgot what the new name you just said that I probably will never remember. Yeah, forgot it again. Thanks. but not in huge concentrations. And
yeah.
And in our community, like it is often linked in terms of this lake to the areas where the nutrients are the highest. Like that's the linkage in Lake Scugog. I'm sure there's other things we can talk about, but it is in the areas where the nutrients are the highest from runoff from the town. So there is a really strong relationship with eutrophication, at least in local areas in Lake Scugog. But that's not always the case. And I think that's another interesting thing that people are maybe not aware of.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, so I guess in terms of causes, we can get into in a second, but also so we've mentioned neurotoxins. And I guess a real common one would also be just taste and odor issues as well, right? Like, I mean, on one case, yes, it can be incredibly dangerous, but there's also the whole, I guess, more widespread issue of unpleasantness associated with them all, with it all as well. And it kind of ties into, I remember years ago, a colleague was dealing with a member of the public, and you know, the complaint was, you got to do something about this. Lakes keep, when the blooms are going on this lake, Every time I walk down to the shore, I vomit. And it's like the you know, glib answer is, well, why don't you stop walking down there? And in a lot of cases, that's not necessarily possible when it's either your backyard or where you're getting your drinking water from, or various other reasons. But it is a fairly big deal on a whole bunch of levels, not the least of which is basically property value impacts as well. Like there's a huge level of concern about blooms, and I'm sure there's got to be some sort of I'm just talking about like hesitation, I guess, or extreme concern of like, you know, especially you talk about Lake Scugog, the sign going in 3 years ago. I think, you know, a lot of deliberation of like, do we need a permanent sign or do we not need a permanent sign? Does that affect the classification of a particular lake and what are the impacts for the community broadly and things like that? Yeah.
Sure. It's like the sign's like 200 meters from the marina. You know, the guy who owns that place has to tell people it's okay to get in the boat and go out and catch fish out in the lake and maybe keep them. So there's all sorts of those linkages. Absolutely. I often dream about being able to afford to buy a cottage. And one of the things I would definitely do is look up the history of that lake and its algal community, its nutrient status, those kind of things. Even though I know, you know, that this is something that does happen, you can't help it. And if you weren't able to process the nuance of that, like someone who maybe hasn't listened to this episode of the podcast, that's a definite issue.
Yeah, I think it's an issue for like the people who are trying to study this as well, because like I think if people who live on small lakes and they've heard about blue green algae and how it can impact property values, if they see a bloom, I think a lot of people are hesitant to report it too if there's only a few cottages on the lake.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
It's not a solvable problem. In turn, like, I mean, on a broad level of education, you know, it's like, I think there'll always be an element of, if we stick our head in the sand, maybe this problem will go away. And it's not until it's like super recurring that it's like, you know, there's a capitulation. It's like, all right, can we do anything about it? But
I guess that means we'll have to use paleolimnological techniques on all of these lakes to reconstruct the history of blooms.
Well, let's go there then. So
not so subtle segue, Josh.
So I guess the next thing is, so we kind of covered blooms and what they are a little bit, but links to eutrophication, and do we know, and I guess this was like a focal point of, as you mentioned, of your thesis, investigating the causes of blooms and are blooms getting more frequent? Can you give a definitive answer to those two questions? Well, I guess starting with the beginning one, are blooms becoming more frequent? Is that an easy question to answer?
No, even that one's not. Like it certainly from the records from the last couple of decades, it looks like they're becoming more frequent. Yeah. And that's from multiple different record types, like from reports from people who live on lakes, as well as from satellite data. It looks like they're becoming more frequent, more severe, and in more water bodies. But we don't really have longer term records than that. And it's really indirect to try to figure it out from the paleo record.
But there's no doubt they're not new. Like this is not a thing that didn't occur in the past. There's lots of old records of blooms.
Like in like Voyager's diaries and things like that of like disgusting slicks on lakes of green. I don't know what the phraseology they'd have used to describe it, but just very obviously they're describing an algal bloom in the, you know, language of the day. So they're a naturally occurring thing, I guess, but teasing apart of, are they a naturally occurring thing that is becoming more common is the trick. on the $1 million question.
Exactly.
And are we doing it? You know, is it linked to something as opposed to a more long-term cycle? Yeah. That's complicated. Yeah. and part of that comes from the many reasons that blooms can form and the how many species did you say?
2,700, but that's just named species. The group probably has like 6,000 or something.
Yeah, thousands of different species, all of which, you know, they're not all one. Just because they have one name doesn't mean they're all responding in the same way. So there's lots of variety in what's driving different taxa to proliferate. It's a very complicated question. I can see why it takes so much energy to try and put it together.
So, and then another aspect I guess we can touch on before we kind of start teasing about potential causes would be, there's definitely the short-term nature of the blooms. Like you mentioned that there can still be dangers after the blooms have dissipated. But like, you know, what would you characterize a short bloom versus a long bloom, Liz, in your research or your neck of the woods? Like, do you get blooms that last for days? Yeah. Do you get blooms that last for weeks? Do you get blooms that last for hours? Like, how long and short? Like, this is where I have no idea of like what the mins and max of the ranges would be. Like, have you heard of anything being just a couple hours long?
I've seen one that was just a couple hours long. Okay. But it's because it depends like where the currents are going and stuff too. Like, I wasn't looking at an entire lake. I was just looking at like a bay where the current was going into. But
okay.
Still, it was visible from like noon to maybe when it got dark, and then the next morning it was gone. So that's like the shortest I've seen. So like on an order of like days, maybe a day or hours, versus like the lake I studied in Algonquin Park. And it's not the only lake in Algonquin Park with blooms, I'll say that. But it had a bloom that lasted, it came on unusually early, like early June, and lasted through till like into September. I don't even know. It might have even been.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It probably went away with turnover in the fall. Oh, but yeah, an entire season. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. I didn't think I was going to say like a month to be stretches.
Yeah, that's got to be like, that's stretching to a good significant portion of the open water season. Yeah.
And I've heard of like, they can be permanent in some lakes, like in tropical areas. So.
Okay. So I guess one thing that really bounced out of me when you're talking there about the one that lasts a couple of hours is the ephemeral aspect of these and how that ties into making it particularly hard to define, because if you're talking about currents and a bloom just taking place in one bay, and it just happened for a couple of hours, and you know, was there a bloom in that lake? You know, it's like there's no hard edges or lines to cross, I guess, or there's great and lots of gradations, I guess, as yes, this small part of the lake blooms regularly when the wind is blowing in a particular direction in a particular time of year.
Yeah, exactly. It gets really tricky.
It kind of reminds me, I heard an analogy. I don't even know where I heard it. It's probably another podcast or something I was listening to, of like complicated problems. And then they tied it to an onion and peeling the layers back. And like, I've heard that one before. And then someone said, but you have to shed a lot of tears before you get to the middle.
But that has issues for all sorts of like, you can't, the likelihood that you get a clear sentinel image, a remote sensing image that can visualize that catches it on that kind of duration is almost impossible. Like the repeat time is 18 days. So that's your chance. That's your window. If it's not going to hit that, Landsat is 16 days, something in that range. And the pixel size is so much bigger. So you're never going to actually see it on those data. Who is going to go and buy like spot data for the lake for every day that they want to find it? It's impossible to do that with remote sensing. So of course they're being missed. Maybe a summer, an entire summer of a bloom, but that makes it a real challenge to see from the from space for some of these more remote locations.
Yeah, definitely. I don't really know a lot about remote sensing and if it's gotten good enough to be able to do like some of the smaller lakes too, because.
Yeah, that would all come down to the platform. It's been used quite a bit in the marine environment, as you would imagine, where you get big open areas. You get the general open ocean is quite dark in color, so it's visually quite an easy comparison to pick out with some of these classification techniques. But for a small lake, you know, the smallest freely available pixel size would be on the order of 10 meters square. So you're not getting a lot of pixels on a fairly small lake. You might get, you know, 10 or 20 across. So that makes it quite a challenge. And there's nothing to compare to the open water environment. So.
And then also, this is where I'm totally talking about my butt and maybe totally wrong, but my little bit I do know about remote sensing is I think there'd be a difference in if you're talking about a surface bloom versus a deeper bloom. Like, I'm not sure entirely how much penetration the various I guess sensing imaging technologies can do. I don't know. Like, do you know anything about that, Josh? Like, could remote sensing be used for subsurface blooms? Like, I literally know almost nothing. I've helped someone take measurements. That's about the extent of it.
Yeah, no, probably not common. Maybe very limited penetration into the water. I mean, most of the platform forms are just reflecting incident light. You know, it's just what's being reflected back across a bunch of different wavelengths. So some of the wavelengths that penetrate deeper into water would maybe be able to reflect off of those blooms, but they would have to be at a really high concentration. They tend, as the platform gets to those longer wavelengths, that the pixel sizes get bigger too. So you would lose spatial resolution anyway. So it would be an issue. There are platforms that are active sensors. You might be able to do things like that, but they would probably blow right through an algal cell in the same way that it did through water right down to the bed. So that's a very good point. If it's not on the surface, if it's not effectively a color difference that you're picking out, that's going to be a big problem.
That's interesting. I've gone on like NASA, what is it, Worldview, and just like flipped through the days and looked at my study lakes. And I've only been able to like visually see a bloom from that satellite data. And I don't know, it must amalgamate like all different satellites, because you can get like, there's daily data. But, and I can only see a bloom on that lake in Algonquin Park. That's the only one I can see. And these are like confirmed blooms. So
there you go. We got to find something else. You got to be on the ground to pick these things out.
I know. They're ephemeral. Even people looking for them will miss them, I guess, in like small cottage lakes, you know, depending on, there's only a couple of cottages on the lake and there's not someone there. Every single day, blooms could be missed. So I guess we're at the point where if only there was some tool set that could somehow indirectly measure the environmental history of lakes, and could that possibly be useful in the study of cyanobacterial blooms? I don't know. What do you think, guys?
Yeah.
I'm not coming
stumped?
Up with anything.
Paleolimnology might be might be a good approach. And I believe you guys might know something about it. So, as someone that has, I imagine there are, basically, I guess, are cyanobacteria a useful paleolimnological indicator, Liz? Do they leave a record directly in the sediments?
Like, kind of, actually, some of them. Okay. If they have resting cysts, those persist for thousands of years. So, but not all cyanobacteria make those resting cells. It's only certain types of actually really common bloom formers. So that's useful. Like a Phanizomenon and a Baena, those groups form these resting cells that you can use in sediment records. So that's like a direct tracer. But like Microcystis or something, no, you have to look at their pigments preserved in the sediments.
Okay. So it's a mixed bag.
What are they made out of? I honestly have no idea. What are the acneates or heterocysts? Which is it?
Acneates.
Acneates. What are they made out of? Like, do you know what's so resistant to thousands of years? That's amazing.
Yeah. And actually what's even more amazing is that they can be viable for that long.
Really?
There's like, I think it's like Legrand 2019. It's a pretty recent paper, but yeah, they found that a 2,700-year-old acne that was still viable.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Has there been, okay, that's an interesting tangent.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. I think it would be really cool if people started doing like resurrection ecology experiments with them and stuff. I don't know what you would do, but it would just be really cool to see like a 2,700-year-old cyanobacteria wake up.
Just look at their DNA, see how much they've changed. Like as bacteria, you'd imagine they're highly
that's true.
Likely to alter them. Or maybe mutable. Not. Maybe they're the same. They've been for thousands of years.
Yeah. Because I could just think of like, I mean, I've got a huge bias to cladocerans and what I've read. And definitely this some cool resurrection ecology stuff where they've done, again, over maybe 50 to 100 years of hatching, of resting eggs, and then doing like toxicity comparisons between, you know, the extant population and your great, 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 great grandmothers kind of thing to see. Has there been some, I guess, adaptation on a community level to whatever the stressor of interest would be? And I think, you know, doing that over.
Yeah, we've done some of that stuff with the mining work.
And much bigger scale.
Do you have any idea approximately how many, like of the ones that are likely to form bloom, some of them leave those behind. So that's good. And for the others, what do we have to think about using instead?
Yeah. So for the others, then we have to turn to photosynthetic pigment tracers in the sediment, which are not, they're useful too. But I like the idea of like a physical fossil, because with the pigments, you get kind of like issues of like preservation more than a physical fossil, I think.
Yeah, I think in terms of intuitiveness and in terms of wrapping your head around what the changes are, you know, relative abundances of an individual fossil is definitely conceptually easier to deal with. Just before we move on to pigments. So the actual resting cysts, how do you isolate them? Do they show up with diatom slides? Are they around in numbers that you can do counts of them on their own? Or are you looking at ratios of them to diatoms? Or I'm not sure. I'm like spitballing here in terms of when you're looking through the scope and you're quantifying cysts, what are you doing them in relation to?
Yeah, I think there's different ways to do it. The way they were done for the study lakes that I looked at them for, I think they can be isolated in the same way pollen is, I think. That's how they were done for mine. And for my cores, they were counted as a ratio to like pollen, green algae, because green algae actually leave like a trace too, like pediastrum, like certain types of green algae. But anyway, yeah, they were counted as like a ratio to all of the other fossils that were left in that sample.
And how much sediment do you need for those? Like, are they abundant?
I guess very little.
Or is it hard to find them?
Not a lot.
Okay, very, okay.
Yeah, and that was in, they were, I got, I had them done from Dixon Lake. So that's where like, they shouldn't have, that lake's like very unimpacted. And the blooms we saw in 2015, we were pretty sure were none had been recorded before that. So we didn't expect to find a lot down core, and still it only took a little bit of sediment to be able to find them throughout the core. So it was like 0.1 dry, I think.
I guess the next question is, how do you go from that to bloom though, from presence of the species to lots and lots of them? Is it the same thing that there's no real cutoff as to what, not only that, I guess the conditions that cause them to produce cysts are not always necessarily the same that are, you know, if there's a bloom, everything's going really well. And generally things create cysts when things are getting a little rough. So how do you deal with that sort of issue?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think the thing is, we're never going to be able to look at the paleo record and say, okay, this, there's some indications here in the sediment record that at this time period, there was more cyanobacteria, like there's more pigments or more acne fossils or whatever, but we're never going to be able to say, okay, that was a bloom. Like, I don't think there's hard thresholds for that.
Because of the nature, or the, is it like, is that a whole bunch of things coming together? Is that like the ephemeral nature of, like, you know, you could have a bloom that only lasts a couple of hours versus a bloom that lasts a season, and it'll just all get lost in the average of a multi-annual slice of sediment? Or that, as well as what's leaving the most record in the sediment, is of when things are rough as opposed to when things are awesome and there's lots of blooming material?
I think it's more the first part. But yeah, like, certainly it's true what Josh was saying before, that like, when they make acne, it's when conditions are not favorable. But still, you would expect that if there's more cyanobacteria, like at the end of the season when things aren't favorable, there's more cells making those resting cells, so you get more acne.
Makes sense, for sure.
And with the same kind of sense, I guess, of like, not being able to identify blooms still hold over when you're looking at pigments? Does a lot of pigment not really give you an indication, at least in recent sediments, of a bloom? Or is it the same kind of thing? It just is a dilution effect and blooms are too ephemeral to really nail it down?
Yeah, I think it's that same thing. I mean, maybe like, you can look at it and see an increase and be like, okay, like, if there's any time that there's likely to be a bloom in this lake, it's when the cyanobacterial pigments are the highest. But I still don't think we can say for sure, if it's back in time and you saw that same level, that those two things were the same in the lake and both were blooms or something, when you have a high point of pigments.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense.
So that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, it is. But the paleo is still useful because you can look at time periods when blooms were most likely happening.
Like, how would that, like, what? Like, how would that work? Like, when they were most likely happening? Do you have an example?
Well, just like when pigments belonging to cyanobacteria were the highest, or when nutrients were the highest. That's if you were going to have a bloom in that lake, that's probably when it happened. And so, like, I don't know if this is the best example, but like in Dixon Lake, that's the one in Algonquin Park, we looked at like five different paleo proxies, because first we looked at the diatoms and there's absolutely no change throughout the 300 year record. And we're like, okay, so there's nutrients haven't really changed in this lake. Like, what's going on? There's no indication that climate warming is impacting the lake in the diatoms. Then we looked at chironomids, not a ton of change, a little bit. Cladocerins, chlorophyll A increasing. It's the highest at the top of the core. So it does look like algal production is the highest now than it's ever been. And then that we looked at the acnes as well, which were in extremely low abundance throughout the core. Like, they only found, like, I think like 10 fossils per interval. And then at the very top of the core, they found 300. So if you looked at that out of context, so we know at the very top of the core, a bloom happened. Like, those sediments correspond to 2015, which is when we saw the bloom in the lake. But if you just look at those fossils, like, that's when a bloom would be most likely to occur. That's when you had the highest acnetes and highest chlorophyll A pigments preserved in the last 300 year period. Who knows what happened before that?
So what's so strange about this lake for all of us, including Adam and I? Can you paint a picture of this little lake? Because it sounds crazy. A bloom that lasts the whole summer in 2015.
Yeah, it's a crazy lake. Actually, when we went there too, so I visited the lake in August 2015 while this like summer long bloom was going on. And we took an oxygen profile from the middle of the lake, and the lake's 18 meters deep there, and the bottom 9 meters had less than a milligram of oxygen. And there's lake trout in this lake. And there are
not for long.
It's a like a flag.
Not anymore.
Yeah. Well, yeah, like Harkness Fisheries Lab is obviously in the park and is like really involved in monitoring the fish in that lake. And they said they seem to be doing okay. They must be going somewhere else. Like it's connected to another big lake, so they must be trying to find oxygen elsewhere. But yeah, it's a very strange lake because, you know, usually everybody ties like nutrient increases to blooms forming in a lake, but there's nothing on this lake. There's nothing in the catchment of this lake, like no development. There was historically logging in the catchment, like in the mid 1800s, but it's recovered. It's all the entire catchment is forested, and it doesn't look like from the diatom records or like the sparse measured chemistry that we have that nutrient inputs have increased at all. So there's obviously something else that's going on that's triggering the blooms.
What else could it be?
Well, I think it could be related to climate warming. A longer growing season.
Okay.
Yeah. And maybe subtle changes in internal nutrient loading. There wouldn't be like a large pool of sediment nutrients to be released because this is like a fairly remote and pristine lake, but there might be some changes going on with oxygen as well, or just a longer growing season.
Okay. Before we go any deeper, is it a unique lake within Algonquin? Is this happening to any other lakes in Algonquin that you know of? Or is this like, could this be a bit of a sea change about to happen? Like, is it particularly big? Is it particularly deep? Is it particularly large? Like, is there anything particularly unique that would say, you know, this is just a weird lake? Outside of the fact of the algal bloom.
Yeah, like I've kind of like racked my brain about it. And like, because that's what everyone wants to know, right? It's like, why this lake? And then, but there are other lakes in the park that have had some blooms, like Lake of Two Rivers, which is on right on the Highway 60 corridor and has some cottages on it. And that one was a big deal because like Dixon's in the interior, like not a lot of people go through. You have to like portage like 2 kilometers or something to get to it. But Lake of Two Rivers has had blooms too, and its phosphorus is even lower. Like the phosphorus in Dixon Lake is like around 10. In Lake of Two Rivers it's like 5 or like 4. And it's had blooms too. But yeah, no, Dixon's not particularly
not even the most tenuous of eutrophication connections there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just pulled it up on Google Earth. It's in the middle of, you got to go a ways to get in there.
Yeah, we flew in, so it was okay.
Yeah, well, that's good for sampling. But yeah, no, it's, how did they even recognize, was it people who were paddling who?
Was it a plane?
Came up with this, showed
them? I think it was a flyover, like someone, like fire patrol kind of general flyovers who noticed it first. But yeah, that was apparently the first time the park had to be like, okay, we need to do something about this, and they shut down the lake to camping because I guess, you know, people when they're camping draw water from the lake and try to filter it to drink it. And they did toxin like measurements and stuff, and they detected toxins. They weren't in exceedance of the water quality guideline, drinking water quality guideline, but still interesting, and no one really knows like the ultimate answer why they happen there, and will they keep happening in other lakes. because they have popped up in Lake of Two Rivers. And I've looked at like algal, because we have phytoplankton data from, I think, 55 lakes in the park that we got that summer in 2015. And I've just scanning some of them, I've seen that like Gliotrichia and some of them has been over 50% of the algal community. So that's a cyanobacteria that's capable of producing toxins too.
A lot of work still to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what set sticks in a park that it could fuel such big blooms those 2 years.
Bunch of questions are bouncing in my mind right now. So one of them is in terms of like conditions becoming right for cyanobacteria. Is it a kind of a situation where everything is already everywhere and when the conditions are right, they explode? Like, or is there any kind of evidence in literature? Is there an introduction aspect to it all? Or is this, they're always there on some low level and conditions are changing to the point that they're really liking it?
I think for the most part, it's that they're always there at some low level and now conditions are right. And like, there are some algal samples from Dixon Lake, for example, from, I think they might even go back to the 60s. And like, you can see the same species are there. They're just in much, much lower abundance. But there are some cyanobacteria species like Cylindrospermopsis Rasiborski. I'm going to say that wrong. But if you guys have heard of that one, people argue that it's invasive. Okay. And has spread up into Canada now. So that's a weird one. But I think for the most part, it's that they're always there. And then conditions are right for them to kind of take over and become out of balance with the rest of the algal community.
So this was in 2015 that the full summer bloom happened?
Yeah.
So in terms of concern about rising algal blooms, like in terms of an environmental stressor of concern, when did that kind of pop up into the radar writ large? Like, were people in like 2000 really like, was algal blooms on a lot of people's radar 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago? Like, when did it kind of like interest kick up in terms of, are the question being raised, are these blooms becoming more frequent? Do you have any, I guess, real general sense of that?
I think so. I mean, people talk about like the 60s and 70s, like algal blooms being like, people were concerned about them and the link was made with nutrient pollution. And then like, if we're thinking of just like Lake Erie and like the Great Lakes, and then things got better and concern went away for a while. And then just since like 1990, the blooms have started to come back worse or like as severe as they were way back when, even though nutrient pollution inputs have declined substantially.
Is it largely in the same places, or are we talking about different places? Whereas, you know, the eutrophication blooms, they went away, but now we're almost talking about like blooms in oligotrophic lakes, which is kind of almost totally separate suite of lakes. And
exactly, you know, and I think that's just been like the last like 15 years, maybe. Yeah, 15, 10 or 15.
Because there's a whole bunch of moving parts at the same time, because at the same time, you've got recovery from acidification happening at the same time. I've talked, you know, with multiple people on lake shores where they said, you know, I remember when I was a kid, this lake was like a swimming pool. And it's like, that was probably because it had a pH of 4. And, you know.
Yeah.
And there was nothing living in it because nothing could live in it. It wasn't an indication of the health of the lake.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so is there an element of recovery from acidification and the rebrowning of lakes tied into all of this as well? Like, as DOC rises, as part of a continental scale recovery from acidification, or is that tied into the same story?
It definitely could be in some lakes. Like, I don't think in all lakes, but there's definitely active research going on about that. In the lakes I've studied, like, I know that DOC now is still kind of recovering from acidification. So, but yeah, it definitely ties into the story because it affects thermal dynamics, which then affect and like light penetration, which affects the algal community greatly. So yeah, it's we're in like a new era of like multiple stressors coming together that we've never seen in the past, because we have recovery from acidification, climate change, and eutrophication all happening at once. So
yeah, and especially in leuotrophic lakes, and then the complexity of like internal loading in a lake that only has like 5 micrograms per liter of total phosphorus. Like, I mean, you know, that's a complicated mess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Those lakes are not supposed to be anoxic. There shouldn't be internal loading in those lakes.
Yeah. Although like, cause that was really big in my thesis, is like, I'm like looking at the midges and I'm like, oh, is there like, is the anoxia worse? Could internal loading be worse now? But Diane Orahel was on my committee and she's like, well, you don't have to have bottom water anoxia to have internal loading. So that's something to consider too. And like warming temperatures can exacerbate internal loading.
So this is, yours was not the final thesis on this, in this work?
No, I definitely think a lot more needs to be done.
What do you think would be particularly interesting directions to go? As someone who's just finished a thesis and, I've been there as well in terms of, four and a half years ago, I set out to address a bunch of questions. Now I know more. I could probably ask some better questions if I was able to do it all over again. And I know with my own graduate research what I would have liked changed at the beginning to get better answers. Was there anything like that for you? Like now, just at the exit, to put you on the spot a little bit, I guess, but in terms of, what is really emerging as, like, if you were to do another thesis, what kind of questions would you be looking to ask? Like, basically for a brand new graduate student going into this, what do you think would be particularly interesting?
I think what's always kind of, like, what's sticking out in my mind recently is, like, okay, so if climate change, climate warming is making these blooms worse, like, what aspect of that is making them worse? Is it the stratification, like, that they can, because they have buoyancy regulation, they can outcompete other algae under more stratified conditions? Or is it literally the temperature? Or is it internal loading? So I think that kind of needs to be teased apart better, which is not, I'm not sure if that's a paleo question.
It's part of it then, where it, in terms of where the difficulties for paleo, if it is such a relatively recent thing, just since the 90s writ large and just since like 2015 in this particular lake, is there just not enough of a record to really tease that apart with paleo data yet? Or is that less of an issue?
Yeah, exactly. Like I think it'll get better as we have longer.
In Dixon Lake, like how deep did you have to go to get to 2015 sediment wise?
It was just the top 0.5 centimeters.
Okay.
Yeah. So then it's like you're looking at one sample that represents the bloom period in this lake and trying to compare to that. And I had other lakes where it was like that too. Like there was only 2 recorded blooms. And so I was trying to figure out what's different about those intervals. But I think, yeah, and lakes with like a longer and more clear bloom history, it would be easier to try to compare. It was better in like, I don't know, like Calendar Bay of Lake Nipissing that I looked at, because they've had blooms there almost every year since 2010. So that was like a little bit better in the sediment record to have like
twice as long.
I think that was like 3 centimeters to look at that represented the bloom period.
So yeah, it strikes me as the kind of thing where Favre lakes would be particularly useful.
Definitely. Yeah. Which like, I guess there's, have you guys heard of Sunfish Lake? I think
no.
I think it's like near Kitchener, but it has varves. And we're like doing some DNA work and spectral pigment work on that one to try to look at bloom history in that lake. But it has, its blooms are weird because they're like deep layer, like oscillatoria blooms at the Metalimnion. So, but still, yeah, it should be interesting to see with a varved record if it's more clear.
Yeah, it's a start. You just need to find more lakes and more records.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I definitely think, like, even just using the same techniques I did, but on a larger scale, or like more lakes would be good. I think, I don't know, some of the lakes, like Callander Bay was the most, it's nice when like I looked at the record and could see like nutrients declining, blooms increasing, and like a clear climate signal in the diatoms, and like lower oxygen inferred from the chronomids. And I'm like, okay, like it's obviously like, this is a traditionally polymictic bay that has now become more stratified. And it was heavily impacted in the past. So it obviously has a lot of nutrients in the bottom waters. And now it's stratifying and there's internal load and that's fueling the blooms. And then we even had some like measured bottom water phosphorus that was like 77 compared to like micrograms per liter compared to like 13 in the surface waters. And it's like, okay, well, that's a clear story. Like it's a clearly climate mediated blooms are happening. But in most lakes, it wasn't that clear at all.
But still, it's good to have those stories as well. Like, I mean,
yeah,
it's a great story to be able to tell as well in terms of when things make sense, they make sense, you know, and, mm-hmm. You know, when some of the complexity is stripped away. No, that's really cool. All of your research that I've seen in terms of the talks and papers that I've read over the last couple of years have been cool.
Thanks, Adam.
I've been definitely interested along the way, and you know, I have a keen interest in this story generally as well as your stuff, and we'd be watching to see if, you know, the veils of ignorance can be pushed back just a little bit more, and maybe some answers will you know, start to emerge in terms of the paleo record as the paleo records get longer.
Yeah. I think there will be progress eventually.
Yeah. And we never even got to talk about what it's like to leave academia and go work at the Federation of Cottagers Association, whatever the acronym is. So we'll have to have Liz on for another episode as we explore moving beyond the ivory tower, because I think that's another place that she would be a good guest. Because you instantly get thrown into the line of fire of people who are interested in these issues and want to know the answers and maybe aren't so willing to accept, well, I don't know, it's a complicated question, beats me. There's like 100 answers why that might be the case. And that's not easy either.
Definitely. Yeah.
All right. So on, you know, that note of cyanobacterial blooms are complex, but we do know more about them than we did both an hour ago and several years ago. Thanks for coming to talk to us, Liz. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
Once again, thanks for listening to Core Ideas, the podcast dedicated to all things paleolimnology. If you'd like to reach out to us with a question or a comment, please send us an email to coreideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can contact us through Twitter at coreideaspaleo, and that's PALEO.
All our past episodes and their corresponding show notes/blog posts can be found at our website, coreideas.ajezyorski.ca. That's coreideas, all one word, ajezyorski, ajezyorski.ca.
And if you're so inclined, you can give us a rating or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Those 5-star ratings would be great, but to be honest, we don't really care all that much. We're just doing this for fun.
And that's it for now. But join us again next time as we continue to explore paleolimnology in the knowledge economy era, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy.